Hey everyone, welcome back. We're diving into some pretty dense legal territory today.
Dense, but important. We're tackling a Supreme Court case you're bound to run into in your studies and probably in your legal careers.
Oh yeah, definitely a landmark one. CBOCS West, Inky Humphreys.
That's the one.
So we'll break it down, not just the what, but also the why. Like, why does this matter for you as future lawyers, you know, beyond just passing an exam?
Absolutely. It gets to the heart of some pretty fundamental stuff about civil rights law and how we interpret statutes.
So if you're ready, let's jump in.
Let's do it.
Okay, just to set the scene. This case went up to the Supreme Court back in 2008, and it all started with a guy named Hedrick Humphreys. He was a black assistant manager at, of all places, a Cracker Barrel restaurant.
Yep, that's right.
And Humphreys, he filed a lawsuit claiming he was fired for two main reasons.
Okay, so what were the two prongs of his claim?
Well, first, he said he was fired because of his race. Straight up racial discrimination.
Makes sense. Unfortunately, still happens way too often.
Yeah, sadly. But the second part of his claim, this is really what made this case so important. He said he was also fired in retaliation for speaking up about another black employee who he believed was also fired because of her race. Her name was Venus Green.
So basically, he saw racial discrimination happening and he spoke up and then bam, he's out of a job.
Exactly. And that's where this really key legal question comes in. It boils down to, does the law protect you from being fired or otherwise punished for speaking up about racial discrimination?
Right. Even if the law doesn't explicitly say retaliation is illegal, is it covered?
Precisely. And that's what CBOCS West really grapples with. Now, to get into that, we need to talk about the legal foundation of Humphreys' case. This is where we get into that post-Civil War legal history.
Okay, lay it on us.
His claim rested on a statute that is super important in civil rights law. It's called 42 U.S.C. Section 1981. It's from the Reconstruction era, after the Civil War.
So, you know, we're talking about a law that was put in place to try to guarantee equal rights to black people who had just been freed from slavery.
Exactly. And what this statute, what Section 1981 basically says, is that everyone, regardless of race, has the same right to make and enforce contracts as white citizens.
That's huge. I mean, think about it. Contracts are the basis of everything in our society. You can't buy a house, you can't get a job, you can't really participate in the economy without the ability to enter into contracts.
It's foundational. And so Humphreys, he's arguing that his firing violated his rights under Section 1981. He's saying, you can't fire me in retaliation for speaking up about racial discrimination because that's interfering with my right to enforce my employment contract equally, just like a white person could.
So the core issue before the Supreme Court was whether Section 1981, which again clearly bans racial discrimination in contracts, does it also protect you from being retaliated against for speaking up about discrimination, even though it doesn't explicitly use the word retaliation?
Yeah, it's kind of a loophole that they're trying to close, you know, because if you can just fire people for speaking up, well, that kind of defeats the whole purpose of the law, right?
Exactly. It undermines the whole thing. It was a really important question. And, you know, unsurprisingly, the lower courts were split on this issue. Some said yes, Section 1981 covers retaliation. Some said no, it doesn't.
So classic circuit split. And that's usually a sign that it's going up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Supremes have to step in and clarify. And in CBOCS West, they did just that. So before we get into what the Supreme Court ultimately decided, let me rewind a bit and go back to what exactly happened to Humphreys at Cracker Barrel and how the case got all the way up to the highest court.
Yeah, let's walk through that a bit more. So you mentioned Humphreys was an assistant manager, right?
Right, assistant manager. And remember, his complaint had two parts, two main issues. One, he said he was being discriminated against himself because of his race.
Right, so like he wasn't getting promotions or raises or something because he was black.
Potentially. But the second part of his claim, the one that became central to this case, was that he was fired for complaining about racial discrimination happening to another employee.
That other employee, Venus Green.
Right. He was essentially saying, I saw them discriminate against her because she was black. I spoke up and now they're firing me to shut me up.
Okay. And this is where things get, you know, legally complicated.
Yeah.
Because his initial claims, they were actually brought under a different law. Not Section 1981, but Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
Oh, yeah, Title VII. Hmm. That's what everyone thinks of when they think employment discrimination.
Right, exactly. It's like the go-to legal tool for those cases.
But there is a catch, though. Title VII, it has all these procedural requirements, like you have to file a complaint with the EEOC within a certain time frame, go through mediation, all that stuff.
That's bureaucracy.
Yeah, lots of hoops to jump through. And unfortunately for Humphreys, his Title VII claims, they got tossed out on procedural grounds.
Oh, so like maybe he missed a deadline or something?
Could be. But the point is, because of those procedural issues, his Title VII claims didn't make it. So all he had left was Section 1981. That's why this case ended up being so important for Section 1981 law. It really put the spotlight on this idea of retaliation and whether it was protected under this older statute, which, you know, honestly hadn't gotten as much attention as Title VII.
So he's in federal court, his Title VII claims are out, and all he has is this Section 1981 claim. What happened next?
So he starts with the district court, and this is where things get even more interesting. The district court actually sided with Cracker Barrel, you know, CBOCS West. They said, no, Section 1981 does not cover retaliation claims. Case dismissed.
Oh, wow. So, like, first he loses his Title VII claims, and then the district court shoots down his Section 1981 claim, too.
Yeah, not looking good for him at this point. But remember, the American legal system, we have appeals courts for a reason.
Right. Checks and balances.
Exactly. So, Humphreys, he appeals this decision to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And, plot twist, they reverse the district court's ruling. The Seventh Circuit, they said, yeah, we think Section 1981 can be interpreted to include protection against retaliation.
So now we have one court saying no retaliation under Section 1981, and another court saying, yes, it is.
Exactly. Classic split between the circuits. And this is why the Supreme Court steps in. The highest court in the land has to resolve this disagreement, and in CBOCS West, they did.
Okay, so the Supreme Court takes the case. Who wrote the majority opinion and what did they decide?
The majority opinion was written by Justice Breyer, and he laid out a really well-reasoned argument for why Section 1981 does, in fact, protect against retaliation. He had three main points, three pillars supporting this decision.
Okay, let's unpack those. What was the first point, the first pillar in Justice Breyer's argument?
Okay, so first, the court looked back at its own decisions, its own precedents. Specifically, they looked at a case from 1969 called Sullivan v. Little Hunting Park, Inc. That case was about Section 1982.
Wait, 1982? But we're talking about 1981.
Yeah, I know, right? Seems confusing, but these two statutes, Section 1981 and 1982, they're really similar. They're both from the Reconstruction era, and they both aim to guarantee equal rights. Section 1982 deals specifically with property rights, while 1981 deals with contract rights.
Got it. So what did this Sullivan case say about Section 1982?
The important thing about Sullivan is that the Supreme Court already said that retaliation claims are valid under Section 1982. And Justice Breyer, he's saying, well, if Section 1982 protects against retaliation, then it makes sense that Section 1981 should too.
I mean, it makes sense. If you're protected from retaliation for asserting your property rights, shouldn't you also be protected for asserting your contract rights?
Exactly. It's about making sure these civil rights laws have teeth, that they actually work in the real world.
So that was the first part of Justice Breyer's argument. Relying on the precedent set by the Sullivan case, what was the second pillar?
The second part of the argument focused on congressional intent. Specifically, Justice Breyer pointed to the Civil Rights Act of 1991. These were amendments that Congress passed to kind of beef up existing civil rights law.
Okay, and what did these 1991 amendments have to do with Section 1981?
They clarified and expanded the scope of Section 1981. Remember, Section 1981 is all about equal rights in contracts, right? Well, the 1991 amendments made it clear that this law covers not just the making of contracts, but also the performance, modification, and termination of contracts. Basically, the whole life cycle of a contract.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't just about the initial signing of a contract. It was about everything that happens after that, too.
Exactly. And the court pointed out that these amendments, they came after a Supreme Court case called Patterson v. McLean Credit Union, where the court had kind of narrowed the scope of Section 1981. So Congress stepped in with these amendments to make sure that Section 1981 had real teeth.
Okay, I see where this is going. So Justice Breyer, he's saying that by passing these amendments, Congress signaled that they wanted a broad and strong interpretation of Section 1981.
Precisely. And because of that, because Congress clearly wanted to protect people from racial discrimination in every stage of the contractual relationship, it just makes sense that retaliation would be covered, even if the word retaliation isn't specifically written in the law.
It's like they're filling in the gaps, you know?
Yeah, it's all about understanding the spirit of the law. Congress wanted to ensure that people can assert their right to equal treatment in contracts without fear of being punished.
Okay, so that's two pillars of the argument, precedent and congressional intent. What was the third?
This one's a bit more straightforward. Justice Breyer pointed to the practical consequences of not protecting against retaliation. He basically argued that if you don't protect people who speak up about racial discrimination, then you're basically gutting the whole point of Section 1981.
Yeah, I mean, what's the point of a law that bans discrimination if people are too afraid to actually report it because they'll get fired?
Right. It creates this chilling effect. People would be so afraid of losing their jobs or facing other consequences that they would just stay silent.
And that allows discrimination to continue unchecked.
Exactly. Justice Breyer argued that this would completely undermine the effectiveness of Section 1981. So protecting against retaliation, it just makes sense from a policy perspective. If you're going to have a law that prohibits discrimination, you have to protect the people who are trying to enforce it.
So that's the majority opinion. A pretty strong argument for why Section 1981 protects against retaliation, even though it doesn't say it explicitly.
Okay.
But as with most Supreme Court cases, there was a dissenting opinion.
Oh, yeah. There was a dissent, and it's actually a really important one to understand. It gets to the heart of some fundamental disagreements about how we interpret laws.
Okay. So who wrote the dissenting opinion, and what was their reasoning?
The dissent was written by Justice Thomas, and Justice Scalia joined him. They took a very different approach to interpreting Section 1981. They argued that the majority was overstepping its bounds, that they were basically rewriting the law instead of interpreting it.
So, like, judicial activism?
That's how they saw it. Their argument was based on textualism. They said, look, the text of Section 1981 is very clear. It says that all persons have the same right to make and enforce contracts as is enjoyed by white citizens. It doesn't say anything about retaliation.
And their point being?
Their point was that the court should stick to the actual words of the law. If Congress wanted to ban retaliation, they would have written that into the law.
So they're saying the court is going too far by adding something that Congress didn't put there.
Precisely. They argued that it's the role of Congress to create laws, not the court. The court's job is to interpret the laws as they are written, not to create new laws.
And they also took issue with the majority's reliance on the Sullivan case.
Right.
Yeah, they did. Justice Thomas, he actually criticized the reasoning in Sullivan itself. He argued that Section 1982, the statute at issue in that case, also doesn't explicitly mention retaliation. So, in his view, the majority in CBOCS West was not only misinterpreting Section 1981, but was also building their argument on a shaky foundation.
So they're basically saying the whole line of reasoning is flawed, going all the way back to Sullivan.
Yep. And it's a really good example of the tension between different schools of legal thought. You have the majority taking a more purposive approach, looking at the intent behind the law, and the dissent sticking strictly to the text. It's a debate that comes up all the time in legal interpretation.
Okay, so we've got the majority opinion, the dissent, all the legal back and forth. Now let's talk about what it all means in the real world, especially for you, our listeners, as future lawyers. What are the practical implications of CBOCS West?
This case has some huge practical implications, especially in the context of employment discrimination lawsuits.
Okay, let's break those down, starting with the most important one for someone going through law school.
Okay, so first and foremost, this decision really expanded the remedies available to people who face retaliation for opposing racial discrimination, especially in employment. Before CBOCS West, if you wanted to sue for retaliation, you pretty much had to rely on Title VII.
And Title VII, remember, that's the main federal law against employment discrimination.
Exactly. But Title VII has some limitations, like there are caps on the amount of damages you can recover. And there's a pretty strict statute of limitations, meaning you have to file your lawsuit within a certain time frame or you're out of luck.
Yeah, those deadlines can be killer.
They can. But now, thanks to CBOCS West, people have another option. They can sue under Section 1981, which doesn't have those same limitations. So even if their Title VII claim is barred because they missed the deadline, they might still be able to sue under Section 1981.
That's really important to keep in mind, especially for you folks out there who are going to be litigating employment discrimination cases.
Huh?
Knowing the nuances of these different statutes and how they interact, that's super important strategically.
Oh, yeah. Huge. CBOCS West definitely expanded the toolbox for employment lawyers. It's also worth mentioning that there's no requirement to exhaust administrative remedies before filing a Section 1981 claim. So you don't have to go through the EEOC first like you do with Title VII.
Yeah, that can save a lot of time and hassle. So that's a big win for plaintiffs in these kinds of cases.
Mm.
What else? What other implications should we be thinking about?
The second big implication is that CBOCS West really helped to create a more consistent body of anti-discrimination law. Before this case, there was a lot of uncertainty about whether retaliation was protected under Section 1981. But now, with CBOCS West aligning Section 1981 with other major civil rights statutes like Title VII and Title IX, we have a more unified legal framework.
Okay, so it's like they're strengthening the whole legal foundation for fighting discrimination.
Exactly. And that's really important because a consistent legal landscape makes it easier for everyone to understand their rights and for the courts to apply these laws fairly.
Consistency is key. So that's two big impacts: expanded remedies for plaintiffs and a more consistent legal framework. What else? What's the third major implication?
This one's more about the employer's side of things. Basically, CBOCS West sent a loud and clear message to employers. If you retaliate against your employees for reporting discrimination, you could be in big trouble.
So, like, a warning shot.
Definitely. And it highlighted the importance of training managers on what retaliation is, because it's not just firing someone. It can be all sorts of things, like demoting them, giving them bad performance reviews, or even just creating a hostile work environment.
Yeah, retaliation can be subtle, but still very damaging.
Absolutely. And CBOCS West made it clear that employers need to take steps to prevent retaliation and to protect employees who come forward with complaints.
It's not just about avoiding lawsuits. It's about creating a workplace culture where people feel safe to speak up about discrimination.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, so we've covered the practical implications: expanded remedies, a more consistent body of law, and a clear message to employers. But beyond the practical stuff, CBOCS West also offers some really important lessons about how we think about the law, about how we interpret statutes.
Oh, yeah. It's a classic example of that ongoing debate in legal circles about textualism versus purposivism.
Can you unpack that a bit? I know our listeners are probably hearing these terms in their classes.
Of course. So textualism, it's this idea that the court should focus solely on the text of the law, on the plain meaning of the words. That's what Justice Thomas was arguing in his dissent. He said, the word retaliation isn't in Section 1981, so the court shouldn't read it into the law.
Stick to the text. That's the textualist approach.
Exactly. But the majority in CBOCS West, they took a different approach. They looked at the broader context, at the purpose of the law, at what Congress was trying to achieve when they passed Section 1981. This is more of a purposive approach to interpretation. They're not just looking at the words on the page. They're trying to understand the intent behind the law.
And they said, well, the purpose of Section 1981 is to eliminate racial discrimination in contracts. And if we don't protect against retaliation, then people will be too scared to speak up. And that undermines the whole purpose of the law.
Right. It's like they're saying you can't just look at the words in isolation. You have to consider the real world consequences of your interpretation.
It's a fascinating debate and one that you'll grapple with throughout law school and your legal careers. How do we balance the need to be faithful to the text of the law with the need to adapt the law to changing times and new challenges?
It's a constant struggle, but it's what makes legal interpretation so interesting and so challenging.
And the majority's decision to rely on the Sullivan precedent, that really highlights the power of stare decisis. You know, the idea that courts should generally follow previous rulings.
Oh, absolutely. Stare decisis, it's a cornerstone of our legal system. It provides stability and predictability. But as you can see in CBOCS West, it can also be controversial, especially when there are strongly held disagreements about the underlying precedent.
Right. Because the dissent in CBOCS West, they were basically saying that Sullivan itself was wrongly decided.
Yeah, they were saying the whole foundation was shaky, which just goes to show that legal interpretation, it's not always cut and dry. There's a lot of room for debate and disagreement, even among the brightest legal minds in the country.
Which makes it all the more important for you, our listeners, to develop your own critical thinking skills and to learn how to grapple with these complex legal issues.
Exactly. Because as future lawyers, you're going to be the ones interpreting these laws and applying them to real-world situations.
So to sum it all up, what's the core takeaway from CBOCS West? What's the one big idea we should all remember about this case?
The big takeaway is that CBOCS West established, once and for all, that Section 1981 does protect against retaliation for opposing racial discrimination in contractual relationships. This decision really strengthened civil rights protections and expanded the legal options available to people who have been discriminated against.
It was a major victory for civil rights, and it also sparked a really important conversation about how we interpret laws, about the balance between sticking to the text and considering the broader purpose and context.
Couldn't have said it better myself. It's a case that every law student should know inside and out.
Absolutely.
Huh?
And on that note, I want to leave our listeners with a final thought, something to chew on as you continue your studies. Thinking about these different approaches to statutory interpretation, the textualism of the dissent, the purposivism of the majority, how might this case, how might CBOCS West influence the way you approach other law, other statutes that you encounter in your legal careers? Because you're going to run into laws that are broadly worded, laws that leave room for interpretation. So how are you going to balance the need to be faithful to the text with the need to adapt the law to new situations to achieve justice?
That's a great question, and it's one that doesn't have an easy answer. But it's the kind of question that good lawyers need to be asking themselves all the time.
Exactly. And with that, we'll wrap up this deep dive into CDOCS West. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and we'll catch you next time.
See you then.